morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today's program, I believe, could be viewed as diverse.
Diverse.
Yes.
Diverse, but all distaff, all from the distaff
exactly.
side. Peter's outnumbered today, outnumbered 5-1. And you, if you can't figure that out at the end of the program, we'll explain it to you. Yeah.
So anyhow, I think that when we start in our discussion with our first guest, Kate Moses, we present the idea that there seems to be a trend blooming on memoirs accompanied by recipes.
And this is a memoir and accompanied by recipes called
Cakewalk.
So here's Kate Moses.
Kate Moses. Yes.
Okay. Here we go, Kate Moses.
Kate Moses, welcome to On the Menu. Could you actually define for me? I didn't really know. It's the title of your book, Cakewalk, but I didn't know what a cakewalk really was until I read the book, and I'm still not quite sure.
Cakewalk, there are two kinds of cakewalk. One is a sort of children's game. I think it originated, it's like an old American thing, and the original cakewalk was that a dance that was done, and at the end, the winner of the dance would get a cake. And now it's become a kind of carnival game or children's game. I've been to one at a children's fair that I wrote about, and there what happens is it's almost like musical chairs. And so the children move around a circle, and whoever is on the winning chair, winning circle in this case, gets a cake. And instead of just having one winner, there are many winners because there are lots of cakes go around.
Now, this is a personal memoir, but you view it also as a memoir about food. And I also put it in a category that's becoming fairly prevalent now about food lit. And we find that food seems to be the emotional connection that people form almost intuitively.
I think that's really true. I thought about that a lot and then did a little research, and it's actually biological that our memory, our sensory memories, are very closely aligned in the brain with the areas where memory is stored. So if you think about food being not just about your taste buds, but about how something smells and how you see it, that those memories are so strong and so powerful that I think it's one of those things that almost all of us have some memory of something that we ate at some point that you can then call up the whole scene of what was going on, what the sky looked like, and who was with you, and what you were wearing. Not just the taste of it, but the feel of it.
Couldn't you look at it another way, rather more cynically, that food and love are a lot of times equated?
Oh, I definitely think that's definitely true.
What I was going to go on and say, and one of them's a whole lot more reliable than the other.
Well, we can hope so.
And I think you're guessing the one different than I am.
Right. Well, no, I was thinking as long as you've got enough food, you'll be okay.
The interesting thing is that for me, growing up in England, if you use the term cakewalk, that meant it was something that was really easy.
Well, yes, exactly, and that's the other meaning of it. And
so you're aware of that meaning as well, of course.
Oh yes, that was definitely the joke for me.
Well, especially considering that your life would appear to be the opposite of a cake.
Yes, this book is very intense. It's your growing up in a dysfunctional family to the extreme, and I have to say it's very intense, and it follows another intense book, Wintering, a novel of Sylvia Plath, that certainly wasn't a cakewalk, right?
No, not at all.
At all.
And in fact, what's funny about, odd and eerie about Wintering is that, my novel about Plath, is that Plath was herself an obsessive baker, and that's been something that's been part of my life since I was a child, and how I ended up writing Cakewalk was because of how I felt that sugar was sort of my savior through a really difficult childhood. And what I found is that when I was writing about Sylvia Plath, it was so difficult and excruciating at times that after I had finished a day of work, I had to go to the kitchen and bake just to let off steam. And so I really baked my way through that book as well as Cakewalk.
Well, now you baked your way through an episode with the family whose name isn't Stickleback, but it looks like Stickleback.
Oh.
Stipple
well, it's actually not their real names, because their real name, actually, I wouldn't want to reveal them because I don't know where they are now.
Oh, of course not.
But their real name was just as funny. Uh-huh. And ironic. And, yes, that was my neighbors when I was a little girl.
Now, what was the name you gave them?
Oh, what did I give them? I've got the book here, but...
Well, you can't even remember when you wrote the book.
Well, you know, some of these, there's so much poignancy in this book, but there are so many hilarious moments, and as I told you, I can relate.
Yes.
I particularly howled over your mother's stealing the monogram towel out of the White House.
Yes, well, you know, and for her, she was just exploring and having a good time, and what happened was we were living in Washington, D.C., and my father worked for the government, and my mother thought that meant we were really special. Well, in fact, what it really meant was, because the Easter egg hunt at the White House is an annual public event, anyone can go. We just happened to get an invitation to an additional tour that we could take at the White House. But she thought this clearly meant big things for our family. And so when she got on the tour, she was very disappointed to see, or to not see, the private residence rooms. She wanted to be taken right through the Nixon's living room. And so she kind of, you know, went on a tour of her own.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. The Secret Service must not have been quite so serious in those days, otherwise your mother might not have survived.
Well, you know what's really funny is that about 10 years ago, I went back on a White House tour with my son, who was then about 11 years old. And I hadn't been back since that first Easter egg hunt trip with my mom when we got into trouble at the end. And while we were inside, I was telling my son about the story of my mother. And one of the Secret Service men, who they have Secret Service all over the place, and they basically are watching out for the tours, make sure you don't go off into the First Lady's bathroom like my mother did. Anyway, he heard the story and how I said that my mother had taken a hand towel or was trying to take a hand towel out of the bathroom. And he caught up with us. The Secret Service guy caught up with us in another room, and he had gotten one of the hand towels from the Clinton White House and gave it to me.
Oh, you're kidding.
Great. He has a great sense of humor.
Oh, yes.
But he also didn't miss a trick. You know, he heard every word I said.
Oh, that's great. Now, you obviously spent some time with some really interesting and important people, like private dinners with MFK Fisher. Wow. What was she like?
Yeah, well, she was really an incredibly lovely woman, and one of the things I remember about her most is she had this tiny little girl's voice, almost like a doll voice, so sweet and gentle in a way, but she was a force to be reckoned with, and she was a lovely, lovely person, but she also did not suffer fools gladly, and being who she was, she was adored by people all over the world, and she did not want to be fawned over. She was happy to have a good conversation, but she didn't necessarily want to always talk about food, because even though she was premier stylist of food writing in the United States, what she was really writing about was life and mm-hmm. love and loss, and she was interested in a much wider range of human experience than you might think if you thought she just wanted to talk about a recipe.
Oh, yes.
And so it was really an incredible experience for me. I was young enough that I didn't really realize how special it was that I got a private audience with her over and over again and got to sit around and talk with her about her grandparents and my grandparents and how we loved cats and that she cooked for me. And that was really incredibly special, I have to say. She was very relaxed about the whole thing. And it seemed that she would come up with a meal effortlessly. And this was at a time when she was suffering from a lot of different health issues, but she still was able to bake cookies and throw a dessert together at the last minute.
Now, people are raving also that your recipes actually work.
You know, not all of them in these kind of memoirs work.
Well, yeah, you know, I think that's probably, if anything, it's the benefit of being an untrained baker, that I have always done it. I cook at home, and I cook for my family, and I think your family is the first, they'll be the first ones to tell you they don't like it.
Right.
And so these are definitely recipes that have been played with over time until everyone really likes them.
I see. So they're really worked over and perfected, huh?
Yeah, well, there, I have some old family recipes. There's a sugar cookie recipe in the book that is exactly the way it was when I was a little girl.
Uh-huh.
I never had to change anything about it. But there's also a gingerbread recipe that was also a family recipe that everyone loved, but I found as a baker that it was difficult to work with. And so over time, I added a little bit more flour, a little bit more molasses, a pinch more cinnamon, this and that. And so when it came time to put the recipe in the book, I realized I had been doing it by feel for so long, I no longer knew what the recipe really was.
Oh, yes.
And I had to test it something like a dozen times before I finally figured out, okay, this is actually it.
I was thinking as I read it, you know, I could write something like this, except for one big thing. I could never be as honest and direct as you are. You faced everything very honestly. Did you withhold anything?
Well, there are some things that I didn't tell about my family experience, and really the reason, there were a couple of reasons. One is because whatever it was that I had to tell, whatever I held back, I had already in some way expressed the same emotions or the same subsequent reactions in some other way, and so felt it would be sort of beating a dead horse.
Yes, it wouldn't.
To go over the same thing. And also, with a book like this, opposed to a cookbook where you're not really telling a story, in a memoir, there needs to be some kind of wholeness to the story. And there were things that I would have loved to put in the book, but they just didn't really work. They didn't move the story forward, or they slowed it down too much, or they would have gotten on to another track altogether. And so that was actually the hardest part. In the end, this manuscript, before the book was published, was probably twice as long.
You have to plan, yeah.
With the help of a really great editor, we cut out things that were painful to let go of, but that made the story told in the book work much better.
Now, looking at this from an analytical perspective, just for a moment before we conclude, it seems to me that there are two kinds of therapy going on here in this book. Therapy one is cooking, specifically cooking desserts and cookies. And then therapy number two is telling the story, getting it out. This is really sort of almost like a
catharsis.
But it's a double catharsis.
Uh-huh.
I mean, just doing the cooking wasn't enough. You had to write the book about doing the cooking as well.
You're absolutely right. And the funny thing is that when I started out writing this book, I didn't know that this was what was going to come out at all. I thought I was going to write a book, sort of a bunch of essays about the sweetness of life and my childhood, or my lifelong obsession with sugar and how that fit into my idea of gratitude and appreciation. And as I got into it, very soon after I started the book, I realized, well, I need to think about where that obsession with sugar came from. And that's when all of these memories flooded back, and I had never made the connection, never until I started writing this book. And so writing the book itself was really a journey of discovery, and recognizing, too, that not only was sugar and having a sweet tooth, no, it was a pleasure I could count on in my childhood. But if you look at it from a broader perspective, less concrete and more in the way we feel things, that it really did give me a sense of appreciation for what little pleasures we all find in life all the time and how important those really are. And I wouldn't have known that. I wouldn't have been able to articulate it without writing the book.
So what's next?
Well, what's next is I've got another novel in the works, and I'm almost finished with that. And the funny thing is that it's been sort of torturous for me to not get more baking into it. But the way this Egypt 2,000 years ago, and there's definitely food, but they didn't have sugar. They had honey. So instead of baking, you have dates.
when that book's getting ready to come out, or when it's just come out, just give Anne enough time to read it, and then we'll talk about that one too. We'll find out what else you found out about yourself through the process of writing.
That would be great.
Okay, the book was a pleasure. Again, listeners, it's called Cakewalk, a Memoir by Kate Moses, and good luck on your next book.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me on the show.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and we're going to be talking to somebody who's really been leading, I think, a pretty charmed life of late. That's hard to say. Sarah Simmons, who actually is a super home cook superstar. And she's done a lot of private chefing and has numerous projects. Let's just listen to how she explains herself.
Talk about a complete turnaround in a life. Sarah Simmons had a day job. For how long was it, Sarah?
Over 10 years.
Yeah, and you did financial planning or advice, or what was it, counseling?
I did retail strategy for some of the world's largest retailers.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we had a friend who did Bloomy stuff. She did.
Oh, really?
She did the, what is it called?
Co-branding and...
Whatever. No, something-based marketing.
Yeah, I forget what it was.
Yeah, so, but anyhow, she still tries a little bit of that, but it's boring.
It wasn't boring for me. It just was the travel was excruciating, and the hours are really long.
So you decided you'd get a job where you wouldn't have to work hardly at all.
Yeah, we
noticed that.
Yeah, so, now I have a job that's exhausting and backbreaking work.
Yeah. Well, bring our listeners up to date on what changed around your life.
So at the end of 2009, I entered a contest with Food & Wine magazine. They held a contest called the Home Cook Superstar, and they were looking for the best home cook in the nation. And I entered, and I won. And my life pretty much changed overnight.
Well, you obviously had been cooking a long time, right?
I've been cooking since I was a child. I just never thought about it being a full-time job.
But what did you do to get this title?
I think it was I had to write some essays and share my point of view on food and share recipes and videos and photos of dishes that I've cooked over time. And I luckily have a lot of content because I have a supper club and I take photos of all of the dishes that I make for my supper club and then when I entertain. And so it was really easy for me to upload a bunch of content because I had it readily available.
Now, were you still doing the other job at this time, or had you already given up?
The time that I entered the contest, I was still doing my other job, and I was taking 6 months off at the beginning of 2010 just because I was a little burnout.
Okay, all right, I see. So, well, wow, that was really remarkable. Now, do you remember what the dish was that you think really pushed you over the finish line?
I don't think that it was any dish in particular. I just think it was the range of dishes that I was making and try to push the envelope a little bit from a flavor standpoint and use techniques that some home cooks might not use. And so I think that that's probably what got me some extra attention.
Give us some examples of this.
Well, I just recently got the smoking gun from Williams-Sonoma that allows you to cold smoke food.
Uh-huh.
And so you can infuse, you know, a wood chip type flavor, a really smoky aroma into, I put it in butter, I cold smoke pasta. I've been working on a dish that uses tea leaves to cold smoke duck.
Yeah, tea's hot right now. I mean, not meaning hot much as ice, but it's really, I just read another whole article about all the different flavors you get from tea and how it's being used. Yeah.
And it's so fragrant. It really does add a whole other dimension to food. And so that's one way, and I make ice creams that are typical chocolate ice cream, vanilla ice cream.
Right.
I try to make some different ice creams, and just in everything I do, I think about flavor contrast and texture contrast, and I approach it like a chef would approach creating a menu for their restaurant when I make a meal in my home.
Well, you sound like a chef.
Now, what did we have the other night in London? We had a chocolate souffle with Lafroy Scotch whisky ice cream.
Oh, and that was good.
That was...
Sounds great.
That was probably the top. I'm not a dessert person, but that one I could eat. It was smoky. It was peaty. It was amazing, yeah. So tell me this. Explain what this City Grit Supper Club is, and it's in Manhattan.
You know, they call them underground supper clubs.
Yeah.
They operate like restaurants, but they're not really restaurants. And it all started when I moved to New York 7 years ago. And it was my first winter out of the South, and I didn't even own I owned what I thought was a winter coat, but what I thought was a winter coat was not a winter coat. And I was so homesick, and I really wanted some Southern comfort food, and I was on the search for grits. And everyone I would ask about grits that I met would turn their nose up at them, and because they just thought of boring pile of grits with butter and salt. And so I set out to prove them all wrong and make them grits lovers. And this was before grits became in vogue and appeared on restaurant menus. So I would start having people over and making them all of these different grit dishes so I could get them excited about grits. And so that started to be a regular thing. And then I started traveling more for work and wasn't able to see my friends enough. And so I would have them over for Sunday supper, you know, pretty much every other Sunday. And then... again, usually serving grits as part of the meal. But then I started eating these amazing meals all of the time when I was traveling, and I wanted to recreate them when I turned home, and so I started to use the supper club as a way to experiment and recreate dishes inspired by dishes I'd had on the road. And it evolved into something where it wasn't just my friends coming anymore. People that met me, when they met me, would say, oh, we heard that you have the supper club. We want to come. And so... strangers started coming, and now it's staying.
Now, hold on. Now, the supper club people, you don't have separate premises for that. The supper club is held at your place?
It is.
Okay.
Now, we interviewed somebody else who did that, two women.
Well, they graduated to planning parties for people. They used to have these great big parties in their own backyard.
Right.
And then they went beyond that because they discovered that it was wonderful to have parties for 50 people, but they wondered where all the money was going.
Right.
But you know, you also have a catering company.
Right, which is funny that now my supper club has turned into kind of a testing venue. So it allows me to test the timing of dishes that I want to make for private catering events.
Uh-huh.
So I can make money from my supper club, but it enables me to do a run-through of dishes that I'm making professionally without having to be out $400 or $500 worth of ingredients.
Well, now, you're also a personal chef, and you have an impressive list of people you've cooked for.
Yes, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah. And who's the most exciting person, you think?
I think that cooking for the Ralph Lauren event this summer and having the vice president of fragrance for... you know, Ralph Lauren corporate, just, you know, come up and tell me that, and he's Italian, and tell me that this is the best pasta that he's ever eaten.
Really?
He's been eating it his whole life. It was pretty spectacular.
And what company is that?
Ralph Lauren.
Ralph Lauren.
Oh, Ralph Lauren.
Yeah,
we just interviewed his daughter.
Yeah, did you meet his daughter, Dylan?
I have met her before.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you've been to the shop or candy shop?
Yes.
Isn't that amazing?
I do love candy.
Do you?
Yeah, it's a weakness. But I try not to eat it. I try to stay clear of high fructose corn syrup, but sometimes you can't help yourself but go crazy at corn candy bar.
You've certainly been noticed along the way. So not only were you Food and Wine's Best Home Cook in 2009, but you make appearances. I understand that you're going to be on the Today Show in a few days' time.
I am. I'm really excited about it.
Is that the first time?
It is. It's the first time. It's a big deal to me because I've been watching the Today Show my entire life.
Uh-huh.
So to be a guest on the Today Show is it's kind of a huge deal, I think.
I have this feeling that you might become a regular, Sarah.
Oh.
I just have that feeling somehow that Giada De Laurentiis might be being pushed out.
Oh, I could never compete with Giada.
Well, yeah, she started out. she started out on very shaky grounds, you know, before a camera.
Well, I guess
she wasn't very good.
Yeah, we may not go there, I guess.
Well, no, but I meant that she's really matured and developed.
But
she studied theater.
But you've got a big online presence too, right?
I do.
I don't know
it's
what
growing.
I don't know what a Tumblr is. Anne said I really don't because I don't know. But you have a place where people can get in touch with you. Why don't you just read that into the program?
Okay. So I have a blog. It's called SarahMcSimmons.com. So SarahMcSimmons.com. And that's my blog that's really the hub for all of the things I do. It talks about my business and it talks about City Grit and the story behind it, and it has craft mentions and recipes, and it's really just the hub of everything about me. But then I have a Tumblr, and Tumblr is kind of a hybrid between a blog and a Twitter feed, and it's really a place for short messages that you can, you know, register to follow someone and sign up to share your information in a really brief way. So what I do is I just share all of the photos of foods from my blog and then link back from my Tumblr to my blog.
And you're up to something new that you can't even tell us about yet, but you have to promise.
I know.
But you're going to promise to come back and tell us when you can.
Yes, because it's really exciting, and I can't wait to be able to talk about it.
And when can you do that? I mean,
we have to get some clearance from some of our investors and paperwork.
We mustn't push you any further. We promise we wouldn't.
Yeah, but I wanted to say that you were in this press release that you are called a combination of Jamie Oliver meets Julia Child, and that's a great idea.
Oh, thank you. It's also a really great compliment.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Sarah, well, listen, I look forward to seeing much more of you and to learning about your new venture.
Thank you. I look forward to talking to you guys again.
Great. Well, you're on. Just give us a signal, and we'll schedule you in. Okay?
All right. That sounds great.
Great. Okay, Sarah. Ciao.
All right. Bye-bye.
And now stay with us as we take another break, and we'll talk to you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again, meeting yet another food personality, Pam Anderson, who we actually caught up with in Charleston. But we had her book. We did have her book, so we knew we wanted to interview her. And she was very accommodating, and we had a delightful discussion. Here's Pam Anderson and her book, Perfect One-Dish Dinners, All You Need for Easy Get-Togethers. Well, there are cookbook authors, and then there are cookbook authors that really have their fingers on the pulse of what Americans are looking for to eat. In fact, not even just Americans. It's a worldwide trend at this point. Pam Anderson is one of those cookbook authors who really knows what she's talking about and is right on the times. Pam, you have a whole series of perfect cookbooks.
I do. My very first book was called The Perfect Recipe. And I have a few books that aren't titled Perfect. One's called Cook Smart and one's called How to Cook Without a Book. But then the others have been perfect recipes for having people over, perfect recipes for losing weight and eating great, and now this new one called Perfect One-Dish Dinners, All You Need for Easy Get-Togethers.
This is really on trend because people want to simplify their lives.
I got the idea because a woman said to me in class, I was teaching a cooking class one day, and she said, "Now, Pam, I can make one dish just fine, but you start throwing in the side dishes and the sauces and the appetizers and fancy desserts, and I just shut down." So I thought, there it is.
Yeah.
Make one big, beautiful, gorgeous, splashy, amazing dish, and the rest can be very simple. You just need one star at a meal, and the rest can be supporting actors and actresses, and it works.
Well, we tried this out. We did a dinner party for, I think, 8, and we did a New England boiled dinner.
Yes.
I hadn't done one of those in 15 years.
Yes.
Boiled cabbage, potatoes, corned beef, brisket, rather.
Yep.
People freaked out. I don't know if it was a memory of childhood or what it was, but they loved it.
In fact, the person who cooked it thought it was pretty much perfect.
There you go.
The only problem was with it was we bought a whole brisket, which was 7.5 pounds. So the recipe delivered enough to fill the two largest pasta pots we have.
It was a logistical nightmare.
And we ate it for a week and a half.
Well, I used to do that when I made choucroute when we lived in Philadelphia for the Mumbers Parade, because we lived near the route.
Yeah.
And I would make huge quantities of choucroute garni.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody would come rushing in from the cold and gobble it up.
It's funny because I've got a recipe for choucroute in the book.
I was going to ask you what other recipes you have. It's a very simple
recipe, in fact. I didn't use any of the long simmering things. I only use short cooking meat so that it comes together very quickly, and then I flavor it at the beginning with prosciutto to give it that sort of porkiness.
Oh, that's great.
And then use only smoked pork chops and ham and that sort of thing, and so it's real quick. And then you mentioned the boiled dinners, and I have two very quick boiled dinners. One, I use rack of lamb, so it's like a little lamb boiled dinner.
Boiled?
I mean, I sear it, and then you just simmer it.
Uh-huh.
So it's very, and with all the vegetables, and then I do one with salmon as well.
And that sounds good.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
What's your favorite party dish?
The one that I just got through demonstrating today was lovely. It's paella.
I was going to ask you about paella because that used to be my go-to party
dish.
Yes,
yes. Everybody loves it. And then you don't really have to worry, unless someone's allergic to shrimp or something, you don't have to worry about everybody's taste because there's chicken in there and there's sausage in there and then there's seafood. And some people love it all and people can kind of pick and choose, so you don't have to worry so much about. Just so lovely. Everybody loves it.
So your paella has both seafood and land food in it in the same
dish. It does.
It is a surf and turf.
Yeah, if you go to Valencia, they'll assassinate you if you tell them you do that.
Oh, good. Well, I think I'll go there.
And then you have to cook it outside on the fire, you know.
Yes, exactly.
And now, do you only include main courses in this cookbook?
Very good question. Thank you for that. I tell people that a one-dish dinner can be as simple as making that one dish and then tossing some baby greens with a few interesting ingredients for salad. Put out a dish of nuts when people first arrive with a nice glass of wine, and then scoop up your favorite ice cream in a nice goblet. But in fact, I do offer complete meal so that I give you the appetizer, the salad suggestion, and the dessert. And then on top of that, it's like, wait, there's more.
Uh-huh.
I give you instant alternatives so that if you don't have time to make the appetizer I've suggested, there's an instant alternative, often using some of the same ingredients that you may have already bought in case you run out of time. You've still got the ingredients on hand to make it simpler.
Happened. I know that.
Yes.
I know. I've been there.
Exactly. So, yes, there are appetizers, desserts, salads, main courses. It's a complete book. And I put the menu together for people. So
this book has got nothing but rave reviews.
Oh.
I think you should be very happy with it. But there you are. You tell me that you just delivered your next book already.
I did, a week ago, and it's going to be out this fall, October 2011.
And it again, is exactly what everybody's looking at right now. Tell us about it.
It's called Cook Without a Book, Meatless Meals. And I'm not a vegetarian. I don't ever see myself, of course, never say never. I don't see myself completely ever giving up meat. But I did want to cut back because I wanted to eat less meat so that I could afford better meat. I'm only buying the best meat that I can afford now. And so as a result of that, I'm eating less. And obviously I think it's a healthier lifestyle too.
Well, everybody seems to be doing it. We have Mario Batali doing Meatless Mondays at Babbo. I think this is amazing.
Well, there are some, when you first cooking that way, you just sort of think pizza and pasta. I don't know. You do have to learn a new way to cook.
Well, Bittman's book is a great place to start. It's called
The
Food Matters Cookbook.
Yes, exactly. I know. I know Mark. Yes, I've read his book, and I know Mark well, and I respect what he's doing.
And he's healthier.
He is.
Right.
Yeah.
It's happening all through the chef world. It's amazing.
Yes, yes. I think we're all realizing that the way we eat and live is not sustainable, and we've got to do something. And so I think we're all trying to do our part.
Well, can you give us a little preview of this book? What are some of your secrets in how you can cook meatless meals?
There's so many little tricks that you can. One of the things that I like in my BLT, my vegetarian BLT.
Tell me what's in it.
I use smoked mozzarella and crumbled pita chips to simulate the smokiness of the bacon and the crunch of the bacon. and then, of course, the lettuce and the tomato. There are other, I make a wonderful meatless Cuban out of a bean.
That's an oxymoron. You can't make a meatless Cuban.
Well, it's funny when you put the ingredients that you associate with that sandwich in there, the mustard, the pickles, the Swiss cheese, then I make a cumin-flavored black bean patty. And it's amazing how it tastes. I do a meatless Reuben by using a hash brown.
I think fried. I count that one.
that one's really good because you put the sauerkraut and the Thousand Island dressing or the Russian dressing and the Swiss cheese on that. And it's incredible how your mind just can make the shift.
But you're absolutely brilliant. You must think about food all the time.
I do. I admit it. And then there are lots of techniques in there, too. There's some recipes, and then those techniques so that you can, similar to How to Cook Without a Book, where I teach people the technique and the formula so that they're not so recipe-dependent for weeknight cooking, so that you internalize the formula, and then you can slide whatever ingredients you have based on the season, what's on sale, what looks good, what you got a taste for, as opposed to slavishly following recipes.
Do you have the ratio, Michael Roman's ratio app on your...
No, I don't, but it's in that spirit. I mean, I wrote the first How to Cook Without a Book in 2000, and that's been one of my best-selling books. People love that.
He's really religious. I mean, it's not even the word I'm looking for. He's very strict about this ratio thing. It's not intuitive. It's
right.
It's mathematical.
Exactly.
And scientific. No.
And this is basically a formula
purist.
That gives you some boundaries, because I believe that it's like coloring, you know what I mean? You know, you have all kinds of creativity within the boundaries, but you need to stay in the boundaries in order to create a dish, otherwise you're just going to end up with a mess. So I kind of give people the basic, a pound of this, a pound of that, in this sauce or whatever, and you can make a stir fry or lo mein or pasta dishes and all those sorts of things that you don't really need a recipe for every single time.
Right, heavens. How do people get a hold of, do you have a website that they can go to?
Man, you are asking all the right questions. I do have a website with my two daughters. It is such a fun thing. I love doing it so much. It's called Three Many Cooks. That's spelled out T-H-R-E-E, the number. Three Many Cooks, as opposed to Too Many Cooks,
yeah,
in Pam Anderson's kitchen. But it's just threemanycooks.com. And you go there, and we post every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. There's a new content.
A lot.
And we also post on Sunday, too, because we are the food columnist for USA Weekend. And we always post the recipe that's in the USA Weekend that Sunday, along with a video demonstrating,
wow,
the three of us in the kitchen demonstrating how to make that dish.
You're busy. How old are your daughters?
27 and 25.
Oh, how wonderful.
And so
we were joking earlier that I've been following you on Twitter without even knowing.
I know. You've been following mostly my daughter because she's the Twitter guru. I leave that up to her.
But we met in Charleston this morning, and without going into details, we'll say that Pam is working on a new book. We're about to announce it for the first time. Doesn't have a publisher yet, but it's called The Perfect Cure for a Hangover.
Anne is the cure for the perfect hangover.
Oh, dear. Well, thanks again, and I hope everybody rushes out and buys these books, because both of them will make their life simpler.
Thank you so much. It's just been a real pleasure to meet you and speak with you.
It's perhaps a good point to note that we actually recorded our interview with Pam Anderson at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival, where we had breakfast with her and also with Sarah Moulton, who's upcoming two or three programs from now. And just a preview to let you know that next week's program is going to be more of the food news that we accumulated while we were in Charleston. So that's upcoming in next week's program. In the meantime, in this week's program... And now it's time to take a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
When we first looked at the next book and the next author that we're going to talk to, we thought, boy, this sounds kind of obvious. The title's How to Squeeze a Lemon, but it turns out there's a whole lot more to this book, as you'll find out in our conversation with...
Laurie Buckle.
How many of you out there really do not know how to squeeze a lemon? If this, in fact, is the case, we could remedy that. We're talking to Laurie Buckle, who's the editor of Fine Cooking magazine, and they've put out a wonderfully, you touch on just about everything. You touch, Laurie Buckle, on just about everything that I didn't even know I didn't know.
I was laughing about that. Yeah, it's a book full of tips and hints for anything that happens in the kitchen, almost.
It's 1,023 kitchen tips, food fixes, and handy techniques. And it's a sequel, right?
It is a sequel, yes. The previous book was called How to Break an Egg.
Now, there are 1,000 in that one, and do you need both books?
Well, I think so, don't you? I mean, can you have
Well, I don't know the answer. You didn't update How to Break an Egg.
We did not. This is in the intervening 5 years, these were all the additional tips that we came up with in the course of testing all the recipes that run in the magazine.
Let's hope that How to Break an Egg is still in print then, so that people can get
it.
It
is indeed.
It is, okay. Wonderful.
A companion volume, yes.
Thank goodness for that. Now, where do you get all... You told us before we came on the air, so we sort of know the answer already, but our listeners don't. Where do all these wonderful ideas come from?
I know, it's kind of amazing to think about that. So we do have a test kitchen, and that's kind of the beating heart of the magazine brand itself. And every recipe that runs in the magazine or on the website or in one of our special issues or books, it's tested a minimum of 3 times and often more, like 5 or 6. It's a precision machine down there. And goal is to get the recipe to the point where anybody with any cooking skill level can open a page of the magazine and start cooking the recipe and have real success with it. And, you know, there's lots of detail, lots of how-to, lots of sort of real information in terms of how you do that. And so in the process of all that testing, we, of course, come up with all sorts of questions and answers and solutions to things, and we keep track of those as we go along, and we often feature them. There's a column in the magazine called The Fine Cooking Test Kitchen, which is our sort of issue-by-issue report on a lot of these things that we have learned, everything from a particular technique to something about an ingredient to a glossary term that we weren't familiar with to a new kind of ingredient that we wanted to introduce readers to. So everything that's kind of filtered through that experience goes into that test kitchen column, as much as we can fit, and then also into these collections of tips that we do. And in addition, we hear from our readers all the time. We have a wonderfully vocal and passionate audience out there who loves to also tell us about the kinds of things that they discover. We actually, on our letters page in every issue, we do have kind of a running contest where readers are encouraged to submit their favorite tips, and we give a prize to the best one. So there's kind of this ongoing conversation, too, about what everyone's learning as they cook. You know, I think cooking itself is really just kind of one long, delicious learning discovery. So this is just a part of that process.
Yeah, because if you don't have the tips, you're not going to be successful, right?
Right. It's kind of like anything, that there's always a better way to do it. And as cooks, look for that and look for new ways to, you know, whether they have a new tool or want to try a different ingredient. You know, that's always that, what do I need to know about this? What's the right way to do this?
Now, here's the challenge that I wanted to explore with you. And I talked to Anne about this before we came on the air. I said, it's wonderful that there are 1,024 tips, but how do you find...
1,023.
But how do you find the one you're looking for?
Now,
let's suppose I've got a problem. How am I going to find out if there's anything in the book that will help me?
That's going to solve that problem for you.
Yes.
Well, there is an index in the back that kind of gives you... a place to begin your search. And then the way the book is organized, I think you might also, it's broken down into equipment or produce or kind of food you're cooking with, technique, what to do when things go wrong. So I think maybe the organization of the book, too, might lead you in the direction of, are you trying to solve a problem? Are you trying to learn more about an ingredient and get you to the right place? But I have to say, a big part of the appeal of this book for me is kind of the bedside aspect of it. It's just such a fun read. It's the kind of thing where you pick it up, you open to any given page, and it's that process of discovery.
So you're saying that one of your suggestions is, unless you think you're perfect, unless you think that there aren't some tips that you don't know, then a useful thing to do would be to actually read it sort of cover to cover.
Like a book, yeah.
So you can have an idea of what's in there.
Yeah, and things you didn't know, too. Yeah, I think often that's so interesting. I never thought, we were joking earlier about some of the funny things in here that I never would have thought of in terms of how to do something or tool to do it with.
I would never have thought that there was somebody who didn't know how to squeeze a lemon so it didn't squirt them in the eye. I mean, there's this common sense element that people
there is
seem
definitely
to...
common sense, but I'm always amazed. Don't you always sort of hear from that first-time cook who's really wanting to know if a clove of garlic, what a clove of garlic actually is, and ending
right.
up chopping the entire head and then learning from that experience. But, you know, everybody starts somewhere. So I think sometimes some of the most basic tips are actually the ones that are very helpful.
You can also forget. I mean,
you certainly can.
I think Miss Ann needs a tip on how to handle a knife sometimes.
I'm guilty of that as well.
Sharp knife meets soft object being cut up, and somehow or other a piece of flesh gets in the way as well.
That's pretty standard at my house, too.
Oh, that happens to you as well?
Yeah, mostly my husband.
It happens.
Do we need to review this technique again?
It happens to me, too. Now, the span of what you have here is really very interesting, because you're not just dealing with, if you like, the conventional housewife's kitchen. I went straight to the section on grilling. Because
I understand you're quite a grill master.
Yeah, the outdoor grill is my place, and I am now in the process, one telephone conversation at a time and one demonstration at a time, trying to transfer my knowledge to our son. And he still seems to have a new question all the time, so he calls me up about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, usually on Saturday or Sunday, when he's getting ready to
in the middle of
cook,
something.
When he's getting ready to cook whatever it is, and he says, "Dad, how long do I cook it for? You know, how do I do that? How do I do the other thing?" So I'm giving it to him.
I think a lot of people feel that way about grilling, you know, because it's not precise the way other kinds of cooking are. There's so many factors to it and so many ways to do something, and a lot of it is really getting to know the process, getting to know your grill and how you like to do it. There's a lot of unknowns about grilling.
There's a superb section on how to clean your grill, which unfortunately is something that, there's no griller that I know who really does it the right way, the way you really should. Because once you're done, you want to sit down and eat the food, you know.
Right, you don't want to mess with
cleaning up the grill. So it's easy enough to just put the lid on and wait till next time. And it turns out that that's one way of doing it.
By the time you heat it up the next time, you mean, and then go ahead and clean it.
One of your recommendations in the book, I mean, I know the tip, is if you want to get your grill clean, then after you've taken the food off, put the lid back on again.
Right.
So while there's still heat coming in the fire, it will cook some of it off, and that's kind of an important thing to do.
You can almost tell which are the tips sent in by readers, because I can't imagine your professional test kitchen would be concerned with peeling a shrimp with a zip letter opener.
No, that probably wouldn't have come from us. That was definitely a reader at home with tools that are slightly different than those we have down in the test kitchen.
And, you know, I wonder how you mash the potato in the peel without splitting the skin.
That is a tricky one, huh?
Well, how do you do that? Do you remember?
That was a reader one, wasn't it? I think that was a reader one.
I'm just mentioning, I can pick out, I think, the kinds of things readers send in, because they get a reward for these tips, right?
Exactly.
And they want to be clever.
Of course. And they're the ones who, you know, we're working to sort of create an environment in the test kitchen that is familiar to everyone who's cooking from the magazine. So we use regular tools and we use ordinary everyday appliances and that kind of thing. And we try to stick with that so that people can replicate the experience. But of course, readers at home, they're trying new things and coming up with ideas that we never would have thought of.
Now, this brings us sort of back to the magazine itself. We were talking earlier, before we went on air, about how was the magazine Fine Cooking actually doing? And you had some interesting stats.
I feel very fortunate, I think, for Fine Cooking. This is an opportune time to be a magazine in the food world that has a kind of a corner on the marketplace. I was telling you, Anne, you know, people laugh at me when I say, well, we're a cooking magazine that's really about cooking. But if you think about it, so many of the food magazines out there right now are about so many other things in the world of food, everything from travel to the history of food to cooking for moms on the go, to celebrity chefs, to, you know, everything else that's happening out there. And we're just have this little, like, corner of the marketplace where we are passionate about cooking, whether that's a 10-minute breakfast that we whip together that is kind of special but very easy, or if it's a weekend project where we've really set aside some time on a Sunday afternoon to make something that we didn't even know we could make, whether that was our own sausage or, you know, our own pasta, something like that. So we love every aspect of it.
Cooks Illustrated, is that a competitor?
I guess you could consider them a competitor. I like to think of them as sort of a friend. But we are similar in that we both have that, you know, that kind of interest in cooking. But at Cooks Illustrated, they are very scientific in their approach.
They're diligent.
I love that when... They're what?
They're diligent.
They are diligent. I love that when you turn to the pages of Cooks Illustrated, you get so much of that background information about the recipe, that, you know, that real confidence that you need to go ahead and try it. But I think we kind of, as much as we appreciate that and as much as we sort of love the science of how things work, we are very much into the idea of exploring all the opportunities that cooking has to offer, and the range of dishes and the range of ethnic cuisines out there, and making discoveries. One of my favorite features in the magazine is this idea of a dish. We tend to call it the challenge, you know, it's sort of that mountain that you always wanted to climb. And what is it? Is it bouillabaisse? Is it paella? Is it something that you've always sort of thought, I don't know what that is and I don't know how to make it, but I'm going to do it. And you find cooking's going to take you through it step by step and walk you through the ingredients and the how-to. And to me, that's different than what Cooks Illustrated is doing. We're into exploration and inspiration, and they're into really that precision of how a recipe is going to work.
Now, how do people get online? I guess you can subscribe online, undoubtedly.
Absolutely, you can. Yes, we're finecooking.com, so it's easy to remember.
Finecooking.com, okay.
And now you sort of have a crystal ball because you work on a good long lead time. So you're about to debut your spring issue.
We are. The April-May issue is hitting newsstands in about 3 or 4 days, which I find very promising because over here on the East Coast, we are ready for spring. I don't know about you guys.
Oh, boy. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, so we're taking the opportunity. We have a wonderful feature coming up on asparagus, which to me is sort of that ultimate spring vegetable.
Sure is, yeah.
It's so interesting. Whenever we do an ingredient feature, our goal is to not do the typical thing with it, but to come up with ways of cooking with it, preparing it that is kind of unexpected and surprising to you. So it's kind of discovering asparagus in a new way. We show people how to shave asparagus and make a salad out of it with Gouda cheese and hazelnuts. We show them how to grill it, which was a lot of fun. I think people often don't think of that. We make a grilled asparagus and steak salad with a yummy kind of Asian vinaigrette. And we even make asparagus fries, if you can believe that. They're coated in breadcrumbs and fried and served with a smoked paprika aioli, and probably just about the best fries I've ever had.
Now,
wow.
Now here's a tip for you for your next book.
Yes.
The grilling of asparagus on the outdoor grill in particular is a challenge because the asparagus stalks just happen to be just exactly the right size to slide down between the... To fall on through. So how do you stop that from happening?
Well, you can do a couple of things.
I have the answer.
Oh, you do have it? I think one thing we have done in the past, and I can't remember if this is exactly in this recipe, but we have put them on skewers, like run the skewers through the top and through the bottom so that they don't flip around on a skewer, and then you have sort of a, it's hard to describe, almost like a placemat of asparagus that you can lay on the grill and then flip over as well.
You knew it already. But
oh, I did? Is that the right answer?
Well, I use about four to the length of the asparagus, and you line them all up, and indeed, you shove them. But you want flat skewers.
Exactly. I think it works better with flat skewers.
Well, if you have round ones, they're going to continue to roll around. But I knew you knew everything already.
No, definitely not.
So, anyhow, everyone should look out for the spring issue because you're talking about the things that are going to make us feel like we're seeing the end of winter.
Yes, it's going to be okay.
So people should just go on to finecooking.com and get a subscription to this magazine.
They can also buy it at the newsstand. We're pretty much at every grocery store on the planet Earth. So
right. They'll
find us at grocery stores and on bookstore newsstands, too.
And those who want to know what they don't know, and find out how to solve a problem that they haven't even realized they have yet.
How to squeeze a lemon and a few other handy tips.
Exactly. How to squeeze a lemon.
They can actually order this book off our website, too.
Well, Laurie, it seems like we run into each other over and over again, and it's always good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
That's all from On the Menu Radio for today. We'll look forward to talking to you again, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.